Each stage of a woman's life brings new possibilities, exciting choices, and sometimes difficult challenges. At Astellas, we understand women want solutions that enable a life of continued possibilities. We will work to elevate the conversation around women's midlife health and provide resources that demonstrate our commitment to women's changing healthcare needs during this stage. Women's Health at Astellas, powering possibilities for women in midlife.
Hello, and welcome to Mayo Clinic Podcast. I'm Dawn Davis, our host for the day. I'm a professor of dermatology and pediatrics at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and I have the privilege of talking to my friend, peer, and colleague, Dr. Jewel Kling today about menopause and hormonal therapy. Dr. Kling, would you like to take a moment to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for covering this really important topic. As you heard, my name is Dr. Jewel Kling. I'm a professor of medicine, the chair of the Division of Women's Health Internal Medicine at Mayo Clinic in Arizona, and most recently have the honor of being chosen as the dean of the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine, our Arizona campus.
Wonderful. I'm glad you took time to introduce yourself because you have so many hats that you wear. So I appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise with us today as you are considered an expert in menopause, sexual health, and hormonal therapy. It's my understanding that the number of midlife women who transition into menopause is substantial, with more than 1 million women in the United States each year entering menopause. Symptoms including vasomotor reactivity, mood disturbances, sleep disruption, and sexual problems and dysfunction are very common during menopause and yet often go unspoken and untreated. Menopausal hormone therapy is an effective treatment for many things, including vasomotor symptoms, and the benefits typically outweigh the risks for many women who don't have contraindications, especially if they are under 60 years of age and within 10 years of menopausal onset. For women who choose or don't choose hormone therapy, there are other over-the-counter non-prescription options. And for that, I'm very grateful for your guidance because there's so much going on in the lay public and in the medical literature about this important time of life. Jewel, I'd love just a little background, if you don't mind educating us on how we got to this point, because menopause was kind of taboo to even speak about, but yet it happens literally to, you know, half the country. So can you give us a little bit of background for our colleagues and peers who aren't very familiar about how women's health and menopause came to be spoken of so that we could advocate for our patients?
Yes, absolutely. Look, you already said it, 100% of women will go through menopause. More than 80% of women will experience symptoms of menopause, including hot flashes and night sweats that can have quality of life impact on them. And so having this conversation is so important for us clinicians because women are going to be coming into our exam rooms and asking us for help. And you're right, the pendulum has kind of swung a bit as it relates to treatment of menopause symptoms, specifically as it relates to hormone therapy. And a lot of this has to do with the history of research as it relates to hormone therapy. So I suspect most listening are familiar with the Women's Health Initiative. And just in brief recap for those maybe that aren't, the Women's Health Initiative was put together in the 1990s, really to try and prove that hormone therapy was beneficial for women, specifically at reducing cardiovascular disease risk. Because up until that time, there had been lots of observational and animal studies that had demonstrated that hormone therapy nearly halved coronary heart disease risk for women. But of course, in medicine, we want the gold standard, randomized controlled trials, and that's what the Women's Health Initiative was. A very large study, over 160,000 women enrolled at 40 different clinical centers that compared women taking either oral conjugated equine estrogen versus placebo if they'd had their uterus removed, or for women that didn't have their uterus removed, they took oral conjugated equine estrogen with micronized progesterone acetate. There we go. They looked at these women and followed them over time. But in 2002, there was a bit of an explosion in the media when the NIH closed the estrogen plus progesterone arm early because of increased risk, specifically coronary heart disease, stroke, breast cancer, and blood clot. And so knowing what I shared about the, you know, observational studies reducing coronary heart disease, it made a lot of clinicians, a lot of scientists scratch their head and be like, this is completely unexpected. What is the deal here? Well, it turns out when you look at the design of the study, that a majority of the women were average age of 63 years of age. The average age of menopause in the US is 52 years of age. So most of these women that were starting on hormone therapy were over the age of 60 or greater than 10 years from their menopause. And it turns out that timing of initiation of hormone therapy matters. What they looked at is the sub-analysis. So women 50 to 59, women 60 to 69, and women 70 to 79, and found that indeed, women that were early in menopause did not have those increased risks that closed the study early. And so this contributes or is supported by the timing hypothesis. Really, again, that the timing of initiation impacts the outcomes related to the medication. And this has now informed our most recent guidelines that say for women less than age 60 or within 10 years from their last menstrual cycle, that the benefits of hormone therapy typically outweigh the risks for women that don't have contraindications. That contraindication list is pretty small. It's heart attack, stroke, breast cancer, and blood clot. I mean, we can talk about that latter one a little bit more because for women that are having really bad symptoms, there may be some things for us to consider there. But for the most part, this is great news that this tool that is the most effective tool that we have for treating hot flashes and night sweat should be safe for most women. But as you alluded to, it just really hasn't hit prime time quite as it was before the Women's Health Initiative.
So a lot of women will have some symptoms that go along with what is considered menopause. But it's my understanding as a non-women's health specialist that women don't just go from being premenopausal to menopausal. And there's a time frame in there that's perimenopause. So how can we educate our patients that there is this shades of gray area and transition zone? Can you tell us a little bit about perimenopause, how long it usually lasts, when it starts, and how does a woman really know when she's gone from perimenopause to being officially in menopause?
Yeah, these are excellent questions, both for us to know, but most times our patients don't know. Maybe I'll speak for myself. You know, you round your 30s, you finished your childbearing, you're just, you know, gliding, doing whatever it is that your career or your mom or whatever in your 40s and don't expect that menopause is right around the corner. And the reality is if the average age of menopause is 52, that perimenopause, which starts 3 to 5 years before that time, is in your mid 40s. And for some women, that may be in their earlier 40s. And sometimes those symptoms can be pretty subtle. It can be increased irritability. It can be sleep disturbance. It could be hot flashes and night sweats or changes to your menstrual cycle. So if you're busy going about your day, you may not notice that something's changing and that you just kind of feel different or feel crummy. And so I think acknowledging that in our 40s is the time that we start to see those perimenopausal symptoms. Now, the definition of menopause is clinical. It's a clinical diagnosis, 12 months past the last menstrual cycle. And so that would be the designation from going from perimenopause to menopause or postmenopausal. But in regards to treatment options, it doesn't really matter. So if you're seeing a woman who's 48, who's still menstruating, but her menstrual cycles are irregular and she's having hot flashes and night sweats, she doesn't have to wait until she's menopausal to start treatment for those symptoms. The treatments that we have are fine to start at that point too.
Fabulous. So the earlier, the better.
Yeah. And one thing I'll say about for perimenopausal women, another thing we may not think about as women is that we're actually able to continue getting pregnant up until 12 months past the last menstrual cycle. So when talking about options for treatment for those perimenopausal women, discussing contraception is important. And the good news is many of the low-dose birth control pills can be used to provide contraception, regulate irregular menstrual cycles, as well as treat hot flashes, night sweats, mood issues, the other kind of perimenopausal symptoms you often see.
Now, speaking of hormones, particularly because we're talking about hormone therapy, for our patients who are perimenopausal, if they take an OCP or if they use an IUD, they may not know when they're officially menopausal because their periods may be suppressed or erratic to begin with. So how as physicians and at healthcare professionals, do we judge that when the woman may not be having obvious symptoms and can't necessarily keep track of her menses? Is it lab draws? Is it some sort of checkpoint list of symptoms? How do we know for sure?
I guess the simple answer is there, it may not matter. You know, if you're treating her symptoms, you're providing her the tools she needs, like contraception, and if that's indicated, there's not really a reason to prove that she's gone into menopause. Low dose birth control pills with like a 20 microgram of ethylene estradiol, or even a 15 microgram or 10. So 10 to 20 micrograms of ethylene estradiol in a continuous format can be given up until age 55. By 56, 95% of women will have gone through menopause. So for women that are having a lot of symptoms, they may choose to continue birth control until that time and then stop and see, hey, am I having symptoms? And should I consider transitioning to a menopausal hormone therapy formulation, or maybe just stop medication altogether? Okay. Similarly for the IUD. Now, IUDs won't stop this cycle. And so even though she may not be having bleeding to signify if she's menopausal or not, she may develop hot flashes and night sweats or other menopausal symptoms. And in that regard, if the timing's right, meaning, you know, late 40s, early 50s, you could consider starting an estrogen. But if you wanted to confirm or check, then checking an estradiol and or an FSH could give you some more information about her menstrual or her menopausal status at that time.
And while we talk about the hormone therapies, and we'll go through them so that we can educate the listeners today, before we do that, just an upstream thing so that we can be clear. For women, for example, who have had a hysterectomy, are the treatment options different or the same based on whether or not you have a uterus?
This is a really important point. So thank you for pointing that out, Dawn. It is different. For women that have had their uterus removed, they don't need a progestogen. The progestogen protects against endometrial hyperplasia and endometrial cancer that you'll see with estrogen therapy. So if you don't have a uterus, you don't need the progestogen. You would just need estrogen treatment. But if you do have a uterus, then it would be an estrogen plus a progestogen. Could either be kind of the bioidentical micronized progesterone versus something synthetic. And we can certainly talk more about those specifics.
And then similarly, on the upstairs side of the body, if a woman's had a mastectomy, whether it be elective or medically indicated, are there certain therapies that qualify or disqualify her with regards to treatment options?
Yeah, whether or not you have a mastectomy is less going to inform the options for treatment, but I think you bring up a really good point and something that women coming to the office always have a question about is breast cancer risk. Because one of the things that the Women's Health Initiative did highlight is the risk of breast cancer associated with hormone therapy. And maybe I'll make a point here to demonstrate that risk is different based on if you need just estrogen because you've had your uterus removed versus you need estrogen plus a progestogen. And in the Women's Health Initiative, the women that were on both the conjugated equine estrogen plus the MPA, they did have an increased risk of breast cancer after about 5 years of use. Now, the good news is that risk of breast cancer was considered small or rare, about the same as if you had 2 glasses of wine per night or if you were sedentary. The interesting news is that the women that were on estrogen alone actually had a reduction in breast cancer compared to placebo. And if they did develop breast cancer, they had a reduction in mortality associated with breast cancer. Now, the formulation of estrogen in the Women's Health Initiative was oral conjugated equine estrogen. So we can't necessarily extrapolate that to all estrogens. And in practice, most of us are using the bioidentical estradiols, like a transdermal estradiol. So it's hard to know if that would reduce your risk of breast cancer, but certainly for women that are concerned about a risk of breast cancer and they don't need a progestogen, an estrogen alone therapy is likely not going to confer a significant amount of breast cancer risk. I would still recommend that they do all the healthy lifestyle habits to reduce their breast cancer risk, exercise, a healthy diet, minimize alcohol, don't smoke, and get their mammogram screening on a regular basis. But certainly for treating quality of life impacting symptoms, they should not withhold a really important treatment.
Great. Well, I heard you mention my favorite organ, the skin, and I know transdermal patches or topical creams are one of the more common ways for women to use estrogen or, you know, dual therapy. So let's get to the treatments. Do you want us to talk about, could you run us through the topical options? We'll start with the skin and then we'll go on.
Yes, absolutely. So there are a few different options that are non-oral, and many of us are prefer starting with a non-oral treatment because it bypasses the first pass hepatic effect. And so it then is safer. You're not going to get the same increased risk of VT that you will with an oral estradiol. And for those non-oral routes or non-oral formulations, you have a patch, a gel, a spray, and there is even a vaginal ring called the Fem Ring. I use the brand name there because there's two different types of, well, I guess there's three different types of vaginal rings. There's one that provides contraception, that's the NuvaRing. There's one that provides systemic hormone therapy to treat hot flashes and night sweats called the Fem Ring. And then there's one that is a low dose estrogen that just treats the local vulvovaginal changes, and that's called Estring. And that's important because a lot of us don't get education about that in our medical school training or residency. And you could recognize that that would be a big difference if you're starting somebody in the wrong ring based on their age. So just knowing that those three options are out there too.
Yeah, that's very helpful to know. Can you clarify, not only for the topical, but also the oral and systemic options, with regards to dosage, do you dose to the minimum that blunts symptoms? And is there any risk relation correlation between dose that you're on per body weight or total dose and the risk of the side effects? Is it linear? Is it a threshold issue? Does it matter?
Yeah, definitely the higher dose of the estrogen, the more risk, particularly as it relates to things like VT risk. Although with the non-oral or the transdermal, that risk is going to be much lower. But we do dose to symptoms. And so sometimes it's determining where women are in their menopausal stage. So women that are perimenopausal or just, you know, newly menopausal may need a higher dose of estrogen to control their symptoms, perhaps a 75 microgram or 100 microgram patch, versus women that are maybe a few years in could try a lower dose, like a 50 microgram or a 37.5. That's all dosages of the patch. And the advantage to the patch is that it does have more dosages. It has five different dosages, the 100, 75, 50, 37.5, and 25. So you can tailor it based on a woman's symptoms. A lot of my colleagues and patients will ask, well, Jewel, are you going to check my hormone levels and titrate to my hormone levels? Well, it turns out that those don't give us reliable information about how to adjust your patch. In fact, your symptoms are a much more individualized way to treat. And so typically we'll make an estimated guess, like an educated guess on where to start, and then work with a woman based on if her symptoms are controlled or not. There's very few side effects from starting hormones. I mean, we've talked briefly about the risk and can go into that a little bit more. But if we overdose, like shoot a little bit high on the estrogen, breast pain, headaches, vaginal discharge are things that we can see. And if that happens, you just reduce the dose of the patch.
That's very helpful. And let's talk about systemic hormone replacement.
The patch, the gel, the ring, the Fem Ring, and the spray are all considered systemic levels of estrogen, so can treat those hot flashes and night sweats. Then there's a whole subset of transdermal estrogens that can be used vaginally to treat the vulvovaginal changes, which we now call the genitourinary syndrome of menopause. You know, the cells within the vagina and the vulva are very sensitive to estrogen. So as the estrogen declines postmenopausally, the cells start to shrink and cause that thin and irritation. And applying estrogen right to that tissue can help restore the integrity of the skin and help with those symptoms. Those low-dose treatments come in a bunch of different formulations too, a cream, a tablet, a capsule, or a ring. Those are all the estradiols. I probably left out, and not intentionally, but probably because we don't use it as much in clinical practice, is the conjugated equine estrogens, which I had mentioned earlier, because that's what was studied in the Women's Health Initiative, in part because that's what was being used most in clinical practice. We don't use it most in clinical practice now, but that's the Premarin or the PremPro. And those are still available. And for some women, there's some circumstances that you would use those, either the pill, the Premarin for systemic treatment, or there's a low dose Premarin for vaginal treatment too.
And so let's talk about oral therapy. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And then the oral, so you have the conjugated equine estrogen, and then you have oral estradiol. And oral estradiol, you'll typically start with a 1 or potentially 2 milligrams of estradiol. Really, any dose of estrogen that you prescribe, you're going to have to give enough of a progestogen to protect the lining of the uterus if a woman has a uterus. which for the micronized progesterone is typically 100 milligrams, but with the higher doses, like the 2 milligrams of the oral estradiol or the 100 microgram patch, you may do a 200 milligrams of the progesterone.
Or if she has an IUD, perhaps, is that sufficient?
Oh, that's a great question. Yes, the progestin-containing IUDs like the Mirena can be really helpful in perimenopause because not only are they a great contraceptive option, but they also help reduce abnormal uterine bleeding. And we will sometimes use them off-label for endometrial protection. So if a woman comes in and she has an IUD, a progestin-containing IUD, her menstrual cycles are treated with that, but she's having hot flashes and night sweats, then you're right. All you have to do is offer her an estrogen, either transdermal or an oral, if that makes sense for her. And then the IUD will provide the endometrial protection.
So as a dermatologist, I can attest that for a lot of vulvovaginal conditions, particularly as we age, in the days of yore, the treatment options were topical steroids or more commonly topical estrogen or topical testosterone. Those have kind of gone by the wayside for many things, but it's my understanding that there are still appropriate uses of topical estrogen and topical testosterone. You've touched on the estrogen part, but we've not talked, ironically, about testosterone. So can you educate me on that?
Yeah, testosterone is certainly an important hormone for us to discuss when we talk about women's health. I guess there's a couple of different areas we can talk about testosterone. The first is I did neglect to mention that there is another treatment for genitourinary syndrome and menopause that is not an estrogen, and it's prasterone. The brand name is Interosa, and it's an androgen, and it's applied, it's a tablet that you insert nightly into the vagina that can also treat GSM, just like the low-dose vaginal estrogens. So that is FDA approved and something that women could consider. Now, there are some conditions that you're probably well familiar with as a dermatologist, like hormonally mediated vestibulodynia, which can be caused by birth control or combined hormonal contraceptives. In those situations, we would stop the offending agent and then consider adding both a topical estrogen and a testosterone to the vulva to help treat the changes. The tricky part is a lot of what we do in our menopause practice is try to make sure women are getting FDA approved bioidentical hormones. So because of the ramifications of the Women's Health Initiative closing early, and a lot of us as clinicians stopping prescribing hormone therapy because we didn't understand those differences in the outcomes based on the timing hypothesis. In many places, custom compounded bioidentical hormone therapy became very popular. And many of those practices claim that these treatments are safe, unlike prescribed medications. But just in the last couple of years, the National Academy of Science did a review and found that most of those claims are just not based in evidence. And in fact, bioidentical is just a marketing term. We do have bioidentical FDA-approved treatments, and they're superior because they have the FDA approval, meaning that their consistency and their safety is reliable. And so this is a long-winded way to say we attempt to do FDA-approved, but we don't have an FDA-approved testosterone available for women in the U.S. We used to, but that got withdrawn from the market because of lack of long-term safety data. However, we do now have two excellent clinical guidelines, including a global consensus statement, and then another from the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health that has summarized the data that we know about testosterone use in women, which really is indicated for one purpose, and it's treatment of hypoactive sexual desire disorder or low libido that's not caused by anything else like relationship issues or vaginal dryness and pain. But for women that have HSDD, a transdermal testosterone that's kept in a premenopausal range can be tried and has been demonstrated to have moderate benefit in her libido.
So are there ever women that really don't have menopausal symptoms and kind of float through this time of life as if it's not a problem?
Are you asking for yourself? Are you like, what do I do to make sure
I'm 26 in my head at all times, Jewel?
Yes, there are women that, you know, skate through menopause without symptoms or minimal symptoms, or women that have symptoms and just decide they don't want treatment, or find other options to help with their treatment apart from hormone therapy. But about 80% of women report having hot flashes and night sweats when they go through menopause. about 30% of that 80% are severe. So it does mean there's a good portion of women that maybe have mild symptoms and smoothly go through menopause.
And then on the other end, are there women who feel like once they enter perimenopause and menopause that even though that's supposed to be a temporary time, that their symptoms last well into their 70s, 80s and beyond, and the symptoms never go away?
Those are the women that we call the super flushers. And there's studies that clearly define this, find that there's about four different categories of the risk for hot flashes and night sweats. And there is a group of women that as soon as they get into perimenopause, they get really bad hot flashes and night sweats, and that just stays. Yeah. And there's no way to know where you're going to fall or how you're going to be. And that's where, you know, a lot of women, a lot of my colleagues will ask, well, okay, now I get it. The timing hypothesis says it's safe to start hormone therapy early in menopause, but when do I stop it? You know, like how do I know if my patient is one of those women? You don't. And so the most recent guidelines from the Menopause Society say that there shouldn't be an arbitrary age cutoff for stopping hormone therapy, because on average, women will have hot flashes and night sweats if they have them for 7 to 10 years. So what most of us do is around age 60, you know, a woman's risk of things like cardiovascular disease and stroke are going to go up just because of her age. So if we can wean down on the dose of the estrogen and then even do a trial off, and if she's no longer having those symptoms, then it makes sense to stop it. But if she weans down or off and has quality of life impacting symptoms, and she's otherwise healthy without contraindications, then through shared decision-making, continuing the hormone therapy makes sense. And that can be something that's just reassessed on an annual basis.
A couple of questions here before we wrap up. Are there any particular racial, ethnic, cultural things that we should know about hormonal therapy or treatment for certain demographics?
The short story there is we need more data. The research is sparse, which is similar to many medical conditions. But what we do know is that Black women and Hispanic women tend to have more significant hot flashes and night sweats, tend to have them longer and get them earlier. And when we look at epidemiologic data, especially around Black women, they tend to be treated less. So they have less access to hormone therapy or being prescribed hormone therapy less. So there's certainly some really important health disparities for us to be aware of and do additional research and then just be cognizant about this in our clinical practice too. Okay.
Can you also comment on the transgender population?
Yes, transgender people, the data that we have to guide treatment through menopause is even more limited than what we have as it relates to race and ethnicity. And so I don't have a lot of great clinical pearls apart from working closely with your patients. And, you know, if you're seeing, for example, a transgender man, so somebody whose sex assigned at birth was female and they identify as a male, so they're on masculinizing hormones, you know, in that regard, likely you're not going to be starting estrogen. This may be a time where using one of the non-hormone options could be considered. And the Menopause Society recently published an update on non-hormone options, and a really kind of cool and interesting, maybe cool for a menopause practitioner, not cool for all you other doctors out there, but there is a new FDA-approved non-hormone medication called fezolinetant that blocks neurokinin B3 in the brain. So it goes and kind of blocks what triggers hot flashes. Now, this has all been studied in cisgender women, but theoretically, these treatments may be beneficial in, say, a transgender man who doesn't want to use estrogen treatment because it may impact their gender affirmation goals. Similarly, for a trans woman, you know, sex assigned at birth was male, but identify as a woman on estrogen therapy, likely their estrogen therapy is going to be helping or, you know, contributing to menopause. Our understanding of that physiology is not very clear either. Like, does a trans woman go through menopause? There's certainly some interesting commentaries, folks that are in this community that have shared about their experience, but we don't have any clear guidance. So again, it comes down to, I think, an individualized discussion with your patient, being cognizant of their goals for their care and what affirms their gender, and then using some of the tools maybe that we use in other regards, like the non-hormone treatments.
Any other pearls of wisdom regarding hormonal therapy, perimenopause, and menopause that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
Well, I think this idea that women have to tough it out or stick it out just doesn't fly any longer. We have wonderful tools. We really clearly understand the safety of hormone therapy now. So for most women less than age 60 or within 10 years from their last menstrual cycle without contraindications, if they're having quality of life impacting hot flashes and night sweats, hormone therapy is a great option. Now we have a good toolkit of non-hormone options for women that cannot use hormone therapy or choose not to. And so I hope folks listening feel empowered to bring those tools into their clinical practice to help their patients. Maybe I'll leave on this note to raise awareness as well. We recently published a paper looking at the association of menopausal symptoms and adverse work outcomes, and indeed found an association between the two. So much so that on average, women reported missing 3 days per year based on their menopause symptoms, which when we extrapolated that to national US data, that's about a $1.8 billion economic loss just because of menopause symptoms. So it really demonstrates that we have some work to do to really help our women patients transition through menopause smoothly with improved quality of life.
Well, Jewel, this has been outstanding. I've learned a lot from you, and it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for advocating for patients and for making sure that women feel empowered to take control of their lives and their bodies. It's very important.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for covering menopause and hormone therapy.
You're welcome. This has been an episode of Mayo Clinic Talks podcast talking about menopause and hormonal therapy with Dr. Jewel Klang. I'm Dawn Davis. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for listening.